Good afternoon. The case for this afternoon is Woods versus McBride. And Mr. Vanderpool.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. The case today before this court is an appeal from the District Court of the Southern District of Indiana from the denial of habeas relief on behalf of the applicant, David Leon Woods, a defendant sentenced to death in the state of Indiana. Three issues are presented in this appeal. The first is whether the district court was correct or whether the district court erred in finding that the defendant who was tried while incompetent was denied his due process rights.
When you say was incompetent, that's your allegation, actually.
It is our allegation.
You're not reciting a fact then, are you?
It's hard to tell exactly.
There's no adjudication of incompetence.
The only adjudication of competence could possibly have occurred on the 20th.
No, I said incompetence.
There's no adjudication
of incompetence.
There was a pretrial adjudication that Mr. Woods was in fact competent.
That is, there was no evidence produced to show he was incompetent.
I would disagree with that.
Take off from there then.
I understand. To understand the claim, it's necessary to cover a very brief amount of facts as to how this all occurred. Mr. Woods was arrested and was preparing for trial, and his two trial attorneys, Johnson and Wary, filed a suggestion of incompetency, alleging that Woods was incompetent because he could not remember the facts and circumstances of the crime. That triggered the Indiana statute 3536.31, which required the court to appoint two or three psychologists or psychiatrists to examine Woods. This the court did as a pretrial proceeding. They filed a report with the court, both of them finding Woods competent to stand trial. That was then used by the court on February the 19th, the first day of trial, to conclude that there was no necessity for a hearing because both doctors concluded Woods was competent. However, on the next day, during voir dire, Mr. Woods was taken back to his cell during the lunch hour
and dozed off.
And Gate was given his prescribed medication, and that caused him to be incompetent on the 20th, where the evidence before the court coming from Woods' own attorney.
Didn't they recess the process so he could regain his senses?
They did. The problem.
So there was no. It was during voir dire, wasn't it?
It was during voir dire. The problem is that the court did not recess that until late in the afternoon. It's difficult to tell, looking at the record, exactly how long that went on.
There's no suggestion here that the voir dire process produced a jury that was in any way unfair to Mr. Woods, is there?
What our argument is that Mr. Woods, while he was sleeping, was simply incapable to assist and meaningfully consult with his counsel during the afternoon of the 20th.
That may be, but it may also not be particularly material to the case here if you haven't made any showing or any allegation that the jury that was ultimately selected in this case was improper in some way, or some people should have been on the jury who were there.
Some of the jurors that were eventually sitting in judgment in Mr. Woods were selected on the afternoon of the 20th, or were at least questioned on the afternoon of the 20th, when Woods was simply unable to remain awake despite his counsel's best efforts to keep him awake, in which they are literally kicking him, hitting him, and pinching him. We are not talking about a case in which a defendant is momentarily inattentive or is intentionally inattentive or is doing something to cause a deleterious...
As soon as the matter was brought to the court's attention, he stopped the proceedings, recessed it, and then went at.
Okay.
As far as I could tell, nobody was selected during the time of the interrogation. He was racked out either. So,
whether they were selected or not, It is our position that
I understand your position.
Okay. I guess I respectfully disagree that certain jurors were not selected during that time frame. Our reading of the record suggested that they were.
Selected and sworn at the time?
Selected in the form of they were passed and became members of the jurors.
Yeah, but they were not sworn in, so the jury isn't impaneled until after they're sworn in.
That's
so
correct.
He was, by the time they were sworn in, he was back in shape. At least he was, insofar as it's possible, back in shape.
Well, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
See, are you arguing that his falling asleep or being drowsy that morning is evidence that he was incompetent? Or that he fell asleep? I mean, you can be competent and fall asleep or incompetent and fall asleep.
There has been no evidence or no argument advanced by either the state, the Indiana Supreme Court, or the PCR court as to how a defendant, while asleep because he was administered drugs, could possibly have a present understanding of what was going on as required under Dusky, or be able to adequately be present in any form other than in body. We believe that the Constitution requires more than mere physical presence, that he have a meaningful opportunity to assist counsel, have a meaningful understanding of what's going on.
If that's the rule you're advocating, what difference does it make when anybody falls asleep during a trial? And that happens sometimes when defendants fall asleep. Let's say. Whenever a defendant falls asleep at a trial, what's the remedy?
It really depends. In this particular case, there are several problems. The first one of which is there was never a hearing conducted for purposes of determining whether or not Woods was in fact incompetent.
What evidence other than his falling asleep would you have presented to a finder of fact to demonstrate incompetence?
What the Indiana...
The only evidence you had was that he was competent, the psychiatrist and the psychologist.
On a pretrial basis, that's correct.
Well, that's when you do it.
The problem is that predates the problem we're talking about.
I think you milk that for about as much as you can in terms of the voir dire examination, and your time is eventually going to run out.
We believe that once the court became aware of an obvious suggestion of incompetency under procedural due process.
You mean his falling asleep?
Yes.
Then it was incumbent on him to do what?
Okay.
What would the court do?
It is incumbent upon the court under 3536.3.1 to again go through the procedures. And it's really a three-part process.
You mean to appoint two psychiatrists again?
Again to examine the defendant to see whether now the defendant is incompetent. And I would point to the court actually to two cases, or one case cited by the state in its brief, suggesting exactly that, decided by this court. And that is the case of State X-Rail Foster, in which this court found that if evidence had occurred that during trial there became a bona fide claim that the defendant was now incompetent.
Yeah, but what he's done is fallen asleep. And what you had a panel, you get two psychiatrists say falling asleep with drugs is an indication of incompetence?
It's an indication that he is unable to assist.
No, that's a given. At that given moment in history, he was unable to talk. He was falling asleep. Well, why would you appoint two psychiatrists or two a psychologist and a couple of psychiatrists to find out what the ramifications of that are?
I'm not sure it would matter.
Why would we have a hearing? And what would you put in at the hearing? Did he fall asleep?
That he fell asleep.
Well, that was that's a given. Everybody agreed to that. There's no finding of fact necessary.
Okay.
Right?
I agree.
He fell asleep. What we're talking about is the legal ramifications, and that has nothing to do with having a hearing. I mean, we have a hearing to determine facts which are in dispute.
It has to do with whether or not, really two issues, procedural due process and a substantive due process question.
Those are abstractions. What we're a hearing is to resolve an issue of fact, right? Questions of law you argue. Questions of fact you have a hearing on. What question of fact would you suggest was going to be resolved by a hearing?
The only one that the doctors could certainly put is that the significance of the drugs rendered him totally incapable.
No, he rendered him asleep. And now that's a fact. You don't need a doctor to say that when people are asleep, they can't cooperate.
Or assist.
So let it go. They've done it.
The problem is, at that point in time, there is no remedy being afforded to the defendant, which is, effectively, we need to strike the panel that's being selected during the time frame.
That motion could have been made to start all over again. Did anybody make any such motion?
The defendant counsel did not make such a motion. However,
would that seem to strike you thinking he didn't think there was anything particularly significant that happened when Junior was nodding off that was coming up to works? I mean,
I think looking at how the trial counsel, Mr. Wary, characterized that certainly belies that concern. When you're literally striking your client, pinching,
trying to wake him up.
Why isn't the trial judge made a pretty nice summary of the situation to the jurors when he excused them for the rest of the day and explained that this wasn't his fault, it won't happen again, and so on. So maybe that. How did that prejudice you?
That's the problem. That goes to whether or not the defendant was prejudiced, not to whether the defendant was or was not competent. You can't wait.
You're saying, competent. I agree that when he fell asleep, he was not competent to assist in his own defense. I say that happens often in trials. All of us have been trial judges. I've had defendants fall asleep. I've had jurors fall asleep. I know of a judge who fell asleep. But what?
Present company accepted, of course.
Yeah. I used to have a rule in juries in Wisconsin that you could fall asleep, but you can't close your eyes. The jurors often would close their eyes, and you would say, "Are you sleeping?" "No, I'm not sleeping."
Anyhow, we're interfering with your program.
So. Go ahead.
I think it's important to remember that this is a side effect of a prescribed medication that the defendant was receiving while incarcerated. This is not a circumstance where the defendant is, for whatever reason the defendant is choosing, falling asleep.
People don't fall asleep usually voluntarily. That's part of the process, but what I want to know is what a hearing would produce. You suggest I should point to doctors again and go through the same procedure. What factual question would they resolve that isn't already obvious on the record?
I'm not sure that would resolve any issue.
Then why have a hearing if there's no resolution of a fact available to you?
That presupposes that what occurred on the 20th, where the court went and excused the jury, constitutes the hearing that's appropriate under due process.
No. It constitutes a question of what would a hearing produce, and if there's no point to the hearing, there's no legal or sensible reason to have a hearing.
If there is no reasonable necessity for the hearing,
right,
it already presupposes then a substantive due process problem in which the defendant is being tried while incompetent. And he's only incompetent.
Okay. I got your point.
Okay.
There must be something else you have to say, I think.
The other two issues presented to the court, I'd like to take in the opposite order that they're presented in the brief. The third issue, Indiana. Defendant concedes he has no right to post-conviction relief. Defendant concedes he has no right to counsel in post-conviction relief. Indeed, he has no right to a direct appeal at all. However, Indiana has set up a process by which a defendant has, as of right, the opportunity to collaterally attack his conviction under our post-conviction relief rules. Something Indiana did not need to do. It also provides the defendant a right to counsel if a defendant is indigent, incarcerated, and raises a meritorious claim. Something, again, the Constitution does not require Indiana to do. Thirdly, it provides an appeal as of right from the denial of post-conviction relief. Again, something Indiana is not required to do. In this particular case, defendant was represented by special public defenders because at his direct appeal, the state public defender who is charged under RPCR rules with representing all indigent defendants on post-conviction had represented Woods on direct appeal. As a consequence, there was a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest in the state public defender again representing Woods on post-conviction. As a consequence, the state public defender appointed special public defenders on Woods' behalf, originally Wagner and Nimmo, and then eventually Lewis and Stebbins. As the case proceeded towards a hearing, the Indiana Supreme Court began issuing orders to the PCR court, telling the PCR court to get the case completed by a date certain, and gave specific dates. Shortly before the hearing that was scheduled, Mr. Woods began to file motions indicating that his counsel was calling him a liar, denigrating him, and that there was a conflict of interest between he and his counsel. His counsels also filed a motion asking for permission to withdraw. The PCR judge, who was under an order from the Indiana Supreme Court not to grant a continuance, effectively had no authority to go and grant that motion to withdraw, and proposed to defendant, Mr. Woods, a man of manifest low intelligence, his option being, well, you can proceed pro se if you don't like what your attorneys are doing. The state public defender, Susan Carpenter, who was conflicted out, did nothing. Most importantly, Mr. Woods' original trial or original PCR attorney, Linda Wagner, began sending letters to everyone who could possibly listen about the significance of the conflict issue. She sent a letter to Judge Ault, the PCR attorney, sent a letter to defense counsel, sent letters to Susan Carpenter, the Indiana public defender, and most importantly, sent a letter to Chief Justice Randall Shepard of the Indiana Supreme Court, all outlining the significance of the conflict that was present. No one did anything. No hearing ever occurred to determine that, to determine the significance of the conflict, nor the ramifications of the conflict.
The only one to be able to do that would have been the trial judge who had the appearance before him, right? Or the PCR.
I don't completely agree with that. Certainly the Indiana Supreme Court on appeal could have sua sponte, since they in fact were aware of the problem through the letter from Wagner to Chief Justice Shepard, was aware of, could have basically interceded at two cases, in two situations, either sua sponte on appeal or in the exercise of its administrative powers, as it was doing in terms of scheduling that, to order the trial judge to look at this problem, to see whether it was a significant problem, to understand the ramifications of that problem. They simply did absolutely nothing. While we concede that Woods does not have a right under the federal Constitution to post-conviction proceedings, to counsel, or to an appeal, once Indiana has set up a process in which he is given a discretionary grant of a right, in this case, three rights. Right, absolute right to challenge post-conviction, absolute right to counsel, and absolute right to appeal from denial. At that point in time, the 14th Amendment kicks in and requires that the process be fundamentally fair and that the defendant have meaningful access to the courts. We have submitted to this court that the case of Evitz versus Lucy sits on effectively the same position, although in a slightly different situation. In Evitz versus Lucy, the United States Supreme Court concluded that the defendant, who had no direct appeal right under the federal Constitution, since the state of Kentucky had granted him that he was then entitled to a due process consideration when the state of Kentucky effectively took that back away from him. That's similar to the other entitlement cases contained within our brief, in which when the state chooses discretionarily to grant rights, it may not arbitrarily take them back, nor create an arbitrary process under which a defendant has no forum to complain of those being either abrogated or limited. We believe that once Indiana has chosen to act in a discretionary field, that it must comport with the due process clause. Finally, as to the middle issue, we believe that the district court erred in finding that the new evidence presented, which was eerily similar to that presented in both Wiggins and Williams, did not command the same result that Wiggins and Williams received. That the court's analysis, based upon both the Indiana Supreme Court and the trial level court's analysis, which incorrectly concluded that Fretwell had modified the Strickland standard and incorrectly aggregated the mitigating evidence in the form of calling it cumulative, is not how it is to be assessed under both Wiggins and Williams, which requires that the totality of the evidence presented both at trial plus the totality of the evidence presented at PCR must be weighed against the aggravating circumstance, in this case, the sole aggravating circumstance. I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Mr. Martin?
May it please the court, this court should affirm the district court's denial of habeas relief because Mr. Woods was competent to stand trial. The trial court had no reasonable basis for questioning his competency, and he received effective assistance of counsel throughout the stages of appellate review and at trial. Initially, with respect to the argument on competency, I wanted to bring some facts to the court's attention. With respect to Judge Bauer's inquiry about a hearing, there was, in fact, evidence taken, some testimony taken, where petitioner testified to a certain extent, and there was some...
When?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When?
I believe it was on the day of the occurrence of somnolence.
You mean when he fell asleep?
Yes, yes, sir.
That was a hearing that day on when he fell asleep?
There was some testimony taken from a correctional officer about the circumstances under which he had taken the Elavil.
That wasn't precisely a hearing. He was trying to figure out why he fell asleep.
Yes. Yes.
We weren't determining his competence. We were just determining why he came in and corked out.
Exactly, Your Honor. I was just saying that to the extent that there was a resolution of factual questions.
Well, I didn't think there was a factual question. I think everybody agreed that he had medicine and he fell asleep.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But there was some testimony taken on that fact. And also, just with respect to his competency throughout, the trial court had noted, because Mr. Woods was sent to a Northeastern center at his initial trial counsel's request and was examined and evaluated there, the trial court had noted in finding him competent based on the opinions of the appointed psychiatrist that it would only consider the evaluations that petitioner had independently obtained if petitioner agreed to allow the court to see those based on the confidentiality. And at no time did petitioner decide to offer that to contest the conclusions of the court-appointed psychiatrist that found him competent. So I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention, and we believe that there's no evidence to show that he was incompetent at any point during these proceedings. Moving on to the question of post-conviction counsel. The state's position is that this is basically a creative attempt to get around the bar at 28 U.S.C. 2261E of raising ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel in federal habeas proceedings. That statutory provision sets forth a number of requirements that a state has to comply with if it's going to provide certain remedies post-judgment in capital cases. And Indiana's scheme provides for all of those, and particularly Crim Rule 24 addresses a good many of them. And I think it's a little bit incongruous to say that there was no process available to Mr. Woods when, in fact, he had, as he noted, a right to a direct appeal from post-conviction review and declined to raise this issue in any form. Now, Mr. Woods uses that as an excuse for not exhausting in the state courts, therefore avoiding a procedural bar here in federal habeas review. And what he says, essentially, is that an attorney cannot be heard to raise his own effectiveness on review. But yet, he says it's not a claim of ineffectiveness. The fact of the matter is, this is a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel and can't be heard. But even if it were cognizable on federal habeas review, these post-conviction lawyers did an admirable job of representing Mr. Woods at post-conviction. The fact of the matter is, there was no divided interest on behalf of post-conviction counsel. What there was a disagreement about how to pursue post-conviction relief. Post-conviction counsel, I want to dispel what I think is something that's somewhat misleading in the argument in petitioner's brief. Petitioner contends that what post-conviction counsel did was kind of bully Mr. Woods into giving it confession at post-conviction, and what Mr. Woods contends is that post-conviction counsel incorrectly assumed that the post-conviction court could then reweigh aggravating and mitigating circumstances. That's not at all what post-conviction counsel did here. Post-conviction counsel, and I mean the record will overwhelmingly support this, was arguing a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. In their attempt to persuade the post-conviction court of this claim, they were trying to show that had Mr. Woods presented a particular version of events and testified at his trial, that it would have made the mitigation evidence more persuasive. And so in getting Mr. Woods to testify at post-conviction, it wasn't in hopes of getting a reweighing of aggravating and mitigating circumstances.
It was presenting what evidence they thought should have been presented at the original.
Precisely, Your Honor. And it was a reasonable strategy. It was thoroughly pursued. It did not result in the granting of relief, but it certainly was anything but ineffective assistance, even when viewed under Strickland's standards. Finally, with respect to the ineffective assistance claim regarding the presentation of mitigation evidence, the district court properly denied relief on this claim. And as we tried to point out in our brief, and I'll just discuss briefly, there is no similarity whatsoever in trial counsel's conduct of the penalty phase in this case to the Wiggins case or the Williams case. There was a great deal of evidence of a deprived, abusive childhood that Mr. Woods suffered, and it was presented at trial. There were a few highlights, if you will, that they elicited from Mr. Woods' sister at post-conviction that is the basis now of this claim on federal habeas review. In short, counsel should have done more. Counsel should have got or should have elicited from Woods' sister these anecdotes in addition to the substantial testimony that was elicited at trial regarding his unfortunate background. Just to bring out a few of those, at trial, the character of Mr. Woods' mother was testified to substantially regarding her lack of affection, regarding her leaving the children alone, regarding having sexual activity in front of the children, providing poor living conditions, striking the petitioner, being with men who struck the petitioner and abused the petitioner. And the record will show that there was a substantial amount of mitigating evidence. There was a cohesive strategy for the penalty phase, and I would direct the court's attention to the deposition of trial counsel Johnston to support that. Mr. Johnston had a strategy, and it was to reduce Mr. Wood's culpability in the eyes of the jury by presenting to him what was a very challenging, struggling upbringing. So, unlike Williams, where there was just cursory references to some difficulties the petitioner had experienced, when in fact they could have shown that he was borderline mentally retarded and just wheeled out a laundry list of horribles, here counsel did his job, and you know, as is often the case, when a family member or a loved one gives evidence in post-conviction testimony, often it's more, and it's more detailed at that stage than it might have been originally.
Might also be more admissible in that stage of the game than would be in the earlier parts. If the defense in the original case is not one of insanity, there's a lot of it that is not particularly admissible at all. Even though to give enormous amount of leeway is given to a defendant to put in whatever, pretty much whatever he wants to put in
at the post-conviction
stage? The trial itself. Because remember, to commit error in favor of the defendant is not to commit reviewable error at all. So the defendant gets a better shot at putting evidence in that he thinks might be pertinent to the inquiry. You try putting it in and see what happens as the prosecutor.
And in this instance, Your Honor, though that may be true, considerable evidence of his upbringing was presented at trial. And in fact, I think the noteworthy thing is that on appellate review and in the trial court, the mitigating circumstance that this evidence would support was credited. There simply is no showing of ineffective assistance on the performance or the prejudice prong with respect to the conduct of the penalty phase in this case. The district court thoroughly considered all the claims that were raised by the petitioner in this case and properly denied habeas relief. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that it affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderpool. Or Mr. Martin. Mr. Vanderpool.
Mr. Vanderpool, without interfering with your time, so don't count this against him, I give you a matter of comfort. The state of Illinois had a post-conviction act that was passed in 1950. It's not constitutionally required. It was required because the Supreme Court of the United States suggested that Illinois better stop the merry-go-round of goofy justice and suggested the drafting of a post-conviction hearing, and that's why we have it. And it was shortly after that that Indiana began to undertake the thing seriously as well. So I tried the first post-conviction act hearing case in the history of Illinois in 1952, and nobody had heard about it. It was
How old are you?
I was a busboy at the Last Supper, but okay. I mean, it was... So I'm fairly familiar with the history of that, but it is not constitutionally required. It was just required because the Supreme Court said you better do it. And, you know, sometimes a whisper is as good as a shout. It's even louder than the Constitution. Now you can turn this talk clock back on.
I defer to your long experience, which is, I think, certainly longer than any of the counsel have been on the face of this earth in this case. I'd like to just turn to two things in rebuttal. What the state has suggested is that there was no error in the district court's finding that the additional significant evidence presented did not warrant relief because the Indiana Supreme Court had originally credited Mr. Woods on his direct appeal with having a turbulent childhood and giving that significant weight. That really misses the point. The question really isn't whether or not some evidence had been brought forward of a turbulent childhood, or whether or not that
is something that should or should not be given significant weight. The question is, under Wiggins and Williams, taking in the totality of what's being presented, both at trial plus what's being presented at post-conviction, does that warrant relief when measured against the aggravating circumstance? It isn't a question of whether it's cumulative, whether it falls into the same general categories.
Was it the same jury? It's a bifurcated trial.
It is a bifurcated trial.
Same jury.
Same jury at trial. That is correct. But obviously when we get to post-conviction, there is no jury present. It's a judge-only proceeding in Indiana. What Wiggins and Williams both tell us is that the proper procedure is to look at the totality of everything presented and weigh that against the mitigating or the aggravating circumstance. That was not done in this case. And in our original brief, we have outlined how close and similar the evidence in Williams and Wiggins are that the Supreme Court granted relief based upon to the evidence presented in Woods' case, aggregating both the PCR phase plus the trial level phase. Finally, the state has suggested that the defendant is procedurally barred from raising the last of the three claims presented here because of a number of different possibilities. One would be that the defendant independently could have filed his own appeal before the Indiana Supreme Court to raise that. That presupposes two things. Number one, that the defendant had a right to file it at all, which we know under the Constitution is not true. A defendant does not have a pro se right to represent himself on appeal, unlike a pro se right to represent himself at trial. It also ignores the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court already knew what the problem was. To suggest that the defendant was required to go through the process of an interlocutory appeal where that had never worked before and never been used before, this is admittedly a bizarre circumstance and hopefully an aberration in how Indiana deals with post-conviction cases. We believe that there were two things required, as this court indicated in Ziegenhausen. Number one is there must be a hearing at some point in time to determine the significance of the conflict, and that if there is, in fact, an appearance of a conflict, that prejudice is presumed to the defendant. No hearing occurred. The defendant was never given an opportunity at any process to bring this forward. And everybody simply ignored the situation, hoping that the problem would go away. We submit that that does not rise to the level of the due process clause under the 14th Amendment, where the state has discretionarily granted the defendant three rights: the absolute right to post-conviction, the absolute right to counsel, and the absolute right to appeal. Once Indiana has chosen to do that, then their actions in either taking away one of those rights, i.e., making the defendant proceed pro se, taking away his right to counsel, cannot be done arbitrarily. He has to be given an opportunity and a forum to go and raise that. None was afforded to the defendant in this case. None was available, whether it be before the trial court who believed he had no authority, whether it was before the state public defender who was conflicted out, or before the Indiana Supreme Court who had the opportunity on two occasions, either on direct appeal sua sponte, or through the administrative use of its powers to ensure that the defendant was receiving the kind of representation that our Criminal Rule 24 mandates and requires, that does not rise to the level of granting the defendant his due process rights under the 14th Amendment. As a consequence, we believe that this court must remand for a determination of the significance of that conflict and proceed accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderpool. Mr. Vanderpool, you were appointed as counsel in this case, were you not?
I was.
The court certainly appreciates your fine work on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
Court be in recess until tomorrow morning, 9:30.